Hello, welcome to The Dude Podcast with me, Gav Thompson. We are the new podcast series from The Dude Lectures. The Dude Lectures is an idea-sharing event from glorious Cardigan Bay in Wales. Recognised by both The Guardian and The Sunday Times as being one of the best ideas events in the world, with over 150 million views of their lectures online, the idea behind The Dude is simply to inspire and encourage people. My job here is to bring that essence to life in a new podcast format. Season 1 is entitled The Story Behind the Person and the Person Behind the Story. A brief summary of my story. I'm the father of three amazing kids, aged 13, 11 and 2. I'm the proud husband to my gorgeous wife, Karina. I'm a tongue cancer survivor, hence the slightly lispy voice and dodgy pronunciation here sometimes. A 26-year career in advertising and marketing. I was the CMO of Paddy Power, Yopa and Bowden and the founder of GiftGaff. But I've now been unemployed since COVID began. You can see more of my story online in my own Dude Lecture from 2012. The Dude Lectures have given me really big shoes to fill here, and up until a few months ago, I'd never recorded a podcast. But my aim here is to tell interesting stories, and in doing so, hopefully inspire and encourage any listeners. Thank you so much for tuning in. I really hope you enjoy this. Season 1, Episode 7, Hostage Negotiations and How to Listen, with Richard Mullander. Welcome everyone to the next episode of The Dude Podcast with me, Gav Thompson, and I am here with Richard Mullander. Richard was the lead trainer at the National Crisis and Hostage Negotiation Unit for the UK police, which was based in Scotland Yard. So he trained his police colleagues on how to negotiate hostage situations and improve communication skills. He's worked abroad a lot in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and he's also trained lots of foreign police forces, including South Africa, Brazil, the Philippines, and Cyprus. He's worked a lot with the United Nations and other governments, and he's now moved into the corporate world, and he's recently been training a range of companies like Shell, like Google, like PwC on improved listening skills. So welcome to the Dude Podcast, Richard Mullander. Richard, after that very long intro, you've clearly done lots of amazing stuff. I think the meat of what I want to talk to you about today is listening and how to be a better listener, or how one can be a better listener. And I think, you know, slightly selfishly, I think when we spoke on the phone, you gave me a few things about listening in the kind of podcast world. So I might hit you up for a few tips on doing a better podcast. But I think just to get everyone on the same page of your history of being, you know, an amazing hostage negotiator, how did you first realise you were good at it? Because it feels like it's not something you stumble into, or maybe you do in the police. Yeah, tell us the story of how you first realised that that was your speciality.
I think hostage negotiation is just an extension of what's gone before. I don't think it's something that you come to and you think, oh, I'm going to become a hostage negotiator. Communication is about survival. And as I went through my life, I went through a whole series of experiences, from being brought up in Brixton, going to a grammar school, you know, coming from a working class background, going to a grammar school, feeling slightly of an imposter syndrome sort of thing. Also being in Brixton and going to a grammar school, when you're walking through Brixton and you've got a jacket on that says, hit me, you know, you have to become aware of what's around you and your environment. And my family were quite volatile. There was nothing nasty, but they were volatile. So there's a lot going on. I was the fifth of six children. And when you're little and all the others are bigger, you know, you kind of watch very carefully. And I think you become very aware. So it's almost this like emotional intelligence, I suppose, is what now people call it. But for me, it's just survival, really.
Right.
And then going out, and I went into the army, so I've done some work in the army, and then coming out and then working in factories, et cetera, et cetera, not really settling down. And then by accident, almost joining the police. And then coming into the police, and without realising it, all of that stuff, all those experiences that you'd had in your life, or I'd had in my life, made me good at being a police officer, because it's kind of like I had my humanity. I'd been in most places that the people I was dealing with had been in, and all of that helped. And then I got to doing interviews, etc. And I found I was really quite good at interviewing people. They were kind of relaxed and they talked to me, and I was almost like poacher turned gamekeeper to a certain extent.
Right.
Not quite. You know.
It's a good cop, bad cop thing, right?
Yeah, well, no. No, the good cop, bad cop is just a waste of time.
Right.
If you put anybody under pressure, they think, and you don't want people thinking.
Right.
So the key is to get someone relaxed. I mean, okay. You never put people under pressure because they'll look at you. You know, if you take me to the Old Bailey, the Central Criminal Court, and a barrister asks me a question, I'm really careful how I answer that question.
Yeah.
But if you meet me in a bar and I'm having a chat, we get nice and casual,
yeah.
And stuff comes out. And maybe, I'm not saying there's anything bad about it, but it may be something that you don't want everyone to know. You know?
Sure.
So that's the secret in any communication, is to get the person relaxed. So going through the interviewing, and then a colleague of mine, who is a good friend of mine, phoned me up and said, look, you know, we need a bit of a change in the way the hostage negotiation is being trained. So will you come over and look at it? Because by now I'd been training a lot of the advanced interviewing in the Met, in, you know, at Scotland Yard. I went across there and I said, well, okay. He said, do you want to be a hostage negotiator? And I said, well, okay, how do I become a hostage negotiator? And he said, well, you turn up. And I said, okay, I turned up. So I turned up. But then you have to do the course, and I went on the course. And the course is great, and the course was always good. I mean, it was always good, but there was lots of things that could be improved. Not so much lots of things, but, you know, it could be developed,
yeah,
rather than improved. I think that's the right word. And, of course, the crossover between interviewing and hostage negotiation is just the same stuff.
Yeah.
It's just worked at a different level of consciousness to all this sense. So people talk about the subconscious competent, you know, where someone just does something and they do it naturally. You can't do that at the elite level. The elite level is conscious excellence. And the best way of describing that is if you think of Lewis Hamilton driving his Formula One racing car, he can only do four things, which is to change gear, steer, accelerate and brake. They're the four things you do in a car. And we all do that. And we can all, but we can't drive like him.
Yeah.
And he can't go 2¾ miles round a lap to 1/100th of a second without knowing what he's doing, without thinking about what he's doing. The trouble with us is we're good at communication, but we don't know what we're doing because we're so good at it, we've forgotten what it is. And so what we do is we work at the subconscious competent, which means we miss loads because we're not working at the conscious excellence stage.
So you've done the course.
Yeah.
You're trying to be consciously excellent. Is that the right expression?
Yeah. And what you're trying to do is to take the skills that you use every day without realising it and then use them realising it. That's the difference.
But there's another difference, though, because if I fluff my lines in a job interview, I won't get the job. Whereas if you fluff your lines in a hostage situation, or you're trying to talk to someone who's sitting on this side of a bridge, you know, someone could die, right? Just by getting your words wrong. Now, clearly, I'm exaggerating to make the point. That's not going to happen. When are you let loose on a real-life situation as the rookie hostage negotiator?
As soon as you finish the training.
Right.
There are no easy ones.
Right.
There are no, let's do this one because it won't be too difficult. There are none of those. So you're straight into it. The training has to be sufficiently good that we can trust the people walking out of that door to be able to stand in front of someone on a bridge and talk them off the bridge.
Right.
And that has to be that good. Because you can't just say,
you can't
have a go.
Have a crack.
No, because there's someone's life at stake.
Yeah.
The day you finish that training, you're now a hostage negotiator.
Right.
And if you're the first one to arrive at a scene, you do the talking.
Yeah. That's quite daunting.
Oh, the first couple. I mean, every negotiation is daunting. The first 10 minutes of any negotiation is I've got no idea where this is going to go.
But like the first time you do anything, like, well, I remember when I learned to fly a plane, the first time you fly solo, you've been trained pretty well, but it's really scary.
Yeah, same to the first time you drive your car on your own.
Yeah.
Do you know, it's exactly the same thing. It's just that when you fly a plane solo, you're on your own. When you're doing a hostage negotiation, there's a team around you.
Right.
So you're not going to be on your own.
Right.
It's rare that you never find yourself completely on your own. There'll either be two of you, but most cases, certainly in London, there's four. Because you can't listen as well on your own as you can. The big key to listening is that, so you're doing the talking and you're trying to listen to me at the same time. You've got to interpret what I'm saying.
Yep.
You're thinking, is this interesting?
Yep.
You're thinking, what's the next question I'm going to ask?
Yep.
You've got to keep going to keep me talking. So you've got to do all of that, and you've got to think about what I'm saying, and you've got to think, and all of that's going on, and it's absolutely cognitive overload.
Yeah.
You're in a dreadful place at the moment because you're thinking, oh, God, where am I going to go with this? What's the next question? Et cetera, et cetera.
It's not that bad.
No, that's
quite good about this.
That's because you're good at it. But what I'm trying to say is you're doing that subconsciously.
Yeah, sure.
Now, I may be saying something that's really relevant, and especially in a hostage or a suicide situation, so I may say something that's really relevant, but because I'm thinking of this question, because I'm thinking, where am I going to go with this? How am I going to do this? Oh, my God, he's going to jump. You know, all of those things are going on in your head. You'll miss that. My number two one, Because the number two doesn't talk.
He just listens.
Oh, shit.
Or she, sorry.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, of course. No, no, no. But, it's a valid
I mean,
point.
Again, my rudimentary knowledge of this, having watched quite a lot of Hollywood films,
yeah,
is it's often about trying to build up trust with an individual.
The thing about trust, and this is another kind of myth, I think, where people make a mistake, is you're given trust. You walk into a door and I trust you. I trust you right now. The thing I asked you was, do I get a chance to edit this?
Yeah.
And you said, okay. Yeah, and there's a kind of a moment there where you're thinking, do I really want to do that or not? You know what I mean? Because it's kind of like, then you think, yeah, okay. Now, the moment you said, okay, I started to trust you more. Because if you said no, then this conversation would have been very different because I'd have been much more careful in what I'm saying.
You'd be much more guarded, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so but I give you trust. Consider trust like this. Have you flown in an aeroplane in the last year?
Yes.
Did you check the pilot's license?
No.
There you go. 35,000 feet in a tube. You have to trust. We have to trust.
Yeah.
You'll catch a taxi. You have to trust. You see a car pulling out. You know it's going to break. You hope it's going to break. You've got a lorry coming towards you. All of those things, that's absolute. You've got to do it. We can't live our life without trust.
Yeah.
What you can't do is break it.
But if I'm a terrorist, right, or a hardened criminal, and you rock up in your police suit, there's an inbuilt, back to stereotypes, there's an inbuilt, you're not walking in with a white flag and a, I'm going to come and sort this out. I think you're coming to stitch me up. There must be quite a lot of...
Well, okay, so let's take the two situations.
Yeah.
Okay, the two situations is, first and foremost, in the hostage situation with an hardened criminal, they never expected to be there. They didn't go there to take a hostage.
Oh, so something's gone wrong, right?
Something's gone wrong. So therefore, they're in a poor situation. Something's gone wrong. So that's the first thing. So, and they now know they're stuck. But what they want to do is to get out of it the best way they can. Because otherwise, because they're not going to go anywhere. Right?
Yeah.
So that's the first thing. The second thing with a terrorist, if you call them a terrorist, be careful, I think, of the word terrorist, because it makes them bigger, stronger, harder. And they're not, these are people
What shall I call them?
I don't know. I really don't know another word for them. Well, not even... You see, this is the trouble. The moment you say wrong-uns, you've judged them. You've got to understand that people do things for a reason.
Right.
And that reason may not be one that's acceptable to you.
Yeah.
But it is to them.
Yeah.
And the other thing you have to understand is that everybody's always right.
In their opinion.
They're right.
Yeah.
So you're wrong.
Yeah.
And that's it. So whenever you're arguing with someone, you can't win the argument because they're right. Tell me one thing you believe in, you know, to be wrong. Whatever the reason they've got it, to them it's right.
Yeah.
And you've got to understand that. And you'll never understand it if you judge them. So you've got to say to yourself, okay, what is going on here? Why do you think this action is going to give you what you want?
And what's your... Sorry to dumb this down a bit or oversimplify. What's clearly an unbelievably complex thing, but what's your opening line with a suicide situation?
It depends on whether I know something about what's gone on before. So if there's something that's gone on before, I'd say, listen, mate, from what I understand or from what I've been told, you're here because of... If it's the first time, if I'm
If it's
not,
like a stranger on sitting on the side of the bridge.
Well, if no one's spoken, if no one's spoken to him, I'd say, what's going on there, mate? What else are you going to say?
Do most of them want to engage with this again? No, fuck off, I want
to... Some of them don't talk. Yeah, I've spoken to someone up a tree for 45 minutes, never said a word.
Right.
But then eventually, you have to wear him out.
Yeah.
But you've got to keep talking. You can't walk away far. Oh, I might have had enough of that and walk away. You can't do that. And then once they start talking, you have to give them time to talk to you because most people have never been listened to. Most people don't get that opportunity to someone to just sit down and say, what's going on, mate? And then what's it all about? And just sit and listen. But as soon as someone says, oh, my mum don't like me. Yeah, your mum loves you. Well, that means the conversation just stopped. But that's what we do because we're trying to solve the problem far too early.
Yeah.
You just got to sit and say, what's going on? What's going on? Tell us about it.
So can you, without obviously disclosing anything you're not very comfy disclosing, can you tell me maybe about just a couple of situations in your career that stand out as being either very remarkable or very dramatic or where you were... The ones that you when you're writing your biography, the ones that you're going to remember.
You remember them all. I think there's... the first one was probably, without doubt, the most traumatic for me, I think. She never died or anything like that, but it was...
Can you tell us about difficult. That?
Yeah, I'm not particularly good at heights, and this is a woman on a windowsill, and the problem was, if you imagine the windows, they didn't open by pulling them down or by pulling them to the side. They opened by pushing them out.
Right.
So you got this idea. So there's this woman, and what she's done is she's climbed... The window has been open at an angle. She's climbed out under the angle and then closed the window.
Okay.
So she's on a windowsill. The trouble is that while she was considering killing herself, there was no fear. So actually she was almost relatively safe because she didn't care. The moment she wanted to come back in, she became frightened.
That's really bizarre sort of twist, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And the problem comes then is to get the window open, you're going to push her off. So it was unbelievably difficult. And we managed it by dropping a rope down, etc. It was on the ninth floor. The only way to talk to her was by leaning out another window. And of course, I'm looking straight down at the concrete and I don't like heights. All of that comes in because none of that goes away. You know what I mean? You're desperately trying hard to get this person to talk to you. And she did talk to us, you know. And in the end, we managed to get her in. But it was like, unbelievably. That's the issue sometimes. It's not so much when they're actually thinking of killing themselves.
It's when
they decide they want to live.
And they've got themselves in such a strange position. You can't get them out.
Yeah.
I'm so scared of heights, I just couldn't even... Is there a moment when you were talking to what you guys call a suicide person? You don't call them a jumper.
You just call
them... The person in crisis. Is there a moment when you're talking to them when you know you've kind of got them?
Just when you think you're winning, that's when you lose.
Really?
Yeah. And there's a big thing about people. It's not so much about... It's a bit like buying a car. Here's the car in front of you. Here's the solution. And right at that moment in time, why don't you buy it? Because all of the risk kicking. And so a lot of time people in suicide intervention don't want to look foolish.
Oh, because there's hundreds of people now watching her.
Absolutely, and what about the neighbours? And they say, here we go again, he's failed again, etc., etc. So you've got all of that to overcome.
It's
really difficult.
Doubling down on how crap they feel.
Yeah, absolutely. And then what you're doing, of course, is you're saying, well, look, you know, it's the solution. And actually, it's not the thing to talk about. The risk is the thing to talk about.
Have you ever come across the same person more than once?
Twice. No, but it's not unheard of. It is unusual.
Is it?
It is unusual, yeah. It's not most people... Once they've kind of visited that place, don't particularly want to visit it again. I think that's the only way I can describe it. I think.
Have you made any sort of, I'd use the word loosely, friends, or if you persuade someone to not take their life,
no,
do they feel some kind of, like, you know?
I don't know, and we don't know. And one of the things we insist on, I suppose, is that that's not our job. My job's not to cure them. My job is to get them off the bridge.
Yeah.
And that's my job. And that's where it stops. It has to stop at that point because otherwise they may well become emotionally attached to you and you become their crutch. And then in order to gain your attention, they'll go up again in order to get you back, you know. And so you cut it dead, you know. And it seems quite...
Brutal.
Brutal, but it's not. It's the only way that we can operate.
Yeah, and I can see why. You must have had some letters from people.
No contact. They don't know who I am.
They don't allow it. So if I'm... massive high spectacle event on one of the London bridges or something, and you know, there's cameras there or whatever, and you talk me down 6 months later when I've recovered again, that's not the right word, but when I've circumstances have moved on, I can't write to you and just...
I'm sure you can write to Scotland Yard if they wanted to. But I think, quite honestly, it's an incident they want to forget. I mean, I don't know. I mean, we don't talk
about it. No, it's just interesting.
It's not something that I've had, and it's certainly not something I would seek. I expect some people have. I don't know. But it's very difficult because that emotional attachment, you can't afford to have it. It's a bit like people that work in the domestic violence domain or the child protection domain, is that there has to be an exit plan. Because otherwise they become very dependent on you.
Yeah.
And you can't have that. Because otherwise you'd be called out all times of day and night to the same person. Oh, come on, Charlie. Oh, I just wanted to talk to you. I don't want to talk to you, you know. It's not...
Okay, that's a good answer. And just back to any more events that spring to mind, any hostage situations that you can share?
There's not... I mean, it's difficult, really. The hostage situations, generally speaking, they're international and they're quite big, and obviously the people are still living, so there's not... I've got no right to talk about those in any way whatsoever. They're very complex, and it's the complexity of those that's the difficulty most of the time. And that's it, you know, how many stakeholders there are.
Yeah.
Because you're constantly, you know, you're getting pulled left, right and centre from different angles. But that's about it, really. It's just talking to people. That's all it is. You want to put some sort of big kind of, oh my God, you know.
There's quite a lot of jeopardy, isn't there?
There is a lot of jeopardy, but it's just talking to people, you know. Yeah. I always think, you know, salespeople has much more in line than I do because you're going to lose your job.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to lose my job. And I appreciate someone may die, which is horrendous, But in the end, if they choose to kill themselves, then I can't do anything about that.
With international situations, presumably, like you said, there's lots of moving parts there, but one of those might be you're trying to communicate through an interpreter.
Yeah.
Now, that must be quite challenging, given some of the stuff I think I know about.
It's the nuances. I mean, that's the trouble. You don't get the nuances. And so you spend a lot of time training your interpreter.
Right.
That's the key, is to make sure that the interpreter understands that they're a machine. That's all they are. They're nothing more than that. They've got no right to have a conversation with the other person. Everything that comes through. They ask the interpreter their name. I'll say Richard.
Right.
And they say, no, what's your name? As I just told you, my name's Richard.
Yeah.
But what's the person who's doing the talking's name? Well, once again, it's me, Richard. And it gets them a little bit pissed off, but in the end, they get the idea that we're not going to say who that person is. Because you can't involve that interpreter, because you don't know where it could be. They could work out who they are, they can go for their family, etc., etc. So the interpreter is a machine.
I read somewhere that in the current day and age, people like you are now sometimes having to do their job via text messaging.
Yeah.
Someone's taken hostage.
Yeah.
That must be quite challenging.
Yeah, absolutely. But it's the same techniques. I mean, whatever form of communication you use, you can still use the same techniques. You can still use certain language and certain styles of talking, I suppose, which will send a message. You know, you can do any number of different things. It's not the problem with a written message is that it's got no tone of voice.
Yeah.
And therefore, what happens with a written message, it can be deliberately misinterpreted, which it often is.
Yeah.
And so, therefore, you have to be really careful about how you phrase those words.
Yeah.
But same techniques. You know, if someone's like, if you're talking to somebody and they've just taken it the wrong way, say, oh, come on, behave yourself. You know, you can quite easily do that.
Yeah.
The thing about it, if you're going to be good at anything like this, then you've just got to be yourself. But it's me talking to you, just the same as I'm talking to you now.
Yeah.
You know, apart from the fact that I'll be listening harder and I'll be thinking, like, okay, where am I going to take this? I wouldn't be doing the talking. This is the same conversation.
Just the jeopardy thing's really interesting. My analysis of it, I quite like presenting to people, but there's a bit of jeopardy. If you're talking to 1,000 people and you stuff it up, people are going to laugh at you. Yeah. If you're acting, you forget your lines, we'll laugh at you. But there's a big bloody if, but if you stuffed it up, and I know we've talked about it, you're not necessarily on your own, but someone could die that you might later reflect, what I said there was not the best thing I could say.
There's absolutely, when colleagues of mine that have lost people will listen to the tape time and time and time and time again.
Yeah.
Think, what could I have done? What could I have done differently? What did I miss? And they will constantly go over that. And in the end, it comes back to some people will kill themselves.
Yeah.
And it's their moment. And it's not for you to stop it to some extent. It's my job is to try and show them there's a different way. There's an alternative.
Yeah.
That's my job. And it's to get them off so I can give them to somebody who can give them more alternatives. But my job is to say, right, look, let's get you off of here, give you a nice sleep, have a good think about what you're doing. That's kind of what we're doing. That's not
what you say.
You know what I mean? And then sit down with somebody and talk it through. You know, and that's our job. And some people say, you know what, mate, I'm really sorry, but I'm going. And they go. You know?
Yeah.
And that's very difficult for negotiators to deal with. It is difficult. The big thing is, there's that speech by Theodore Roosevelt, which I love. You know, it's not the critic that counts, it's the man that stands in the arena or the person.
Yeah.
And I think that's the difference between hostage negotiators and other people, is that they walk into the arena.
Yeah, you're in the arena. Think of it, right?
Yeah, but you make cock-ups. You know, you can make a cock-up and you can upset somebody and you can get over it. It's just the same. If you and I are having a conversation and I say something wrong, you go, oh, I'm not particularly every day. Oh, look, I'm sorry, mate. That's what I meant. You know, but it's so, it's not like you kind of, oh my God, I better not say that.
Is there, again, I'd imagine, again, because I've watched enough Hollywood movies, that there's a situation where something's gone wrong, things have escalated. I'm in Hollywood land now. The perp, right?
Yeah.
It's now in so much deep shit that he's kind of thinking, you know what, I'm going to prison anyway. I accidentally shot someone. The jeopardy stakes are so high that your levers you can pull in negotiation that I'm kind of going, I'm fucked. What have you got to offer me? Just sort of, there's so much has gone wrong.
Yeah.
How do you, sorry, I'm asking really annoying questions.
No, not at all. No, they're not annoying questions at all.
How do you kind of take the pressure out?
The pressure's always on. The problem is what would they gain by hurting anybody?
But maybe someone's already got hurt.
But then what you're saying, they're not going to come out because someone's already hurt. But why would they hurt someone else then? What would that achieve?
Well, they might think they can make a getaway.
So they think they're going to get a getaway.
Right, so we're trying to write a really shit Hollywood film now together.
Yeah, but if you say to them, listen, mate, you know, if you kill anyone else, well, no one's going to let you out. No one's going to do that, are they? You know, it's like, why would you shoot anyone else? What's he going to achieve? You're saying to me that you're really sorry you've done this, and now you're doing something else. So help me out here. How does that work?
Okay, let's not write the script now. Okay, right. All very, very interesting. I genuinely talked to you all day about that. But actually, one of the things when I read your book at speed was the second myth of listening, or maybe it was the third, was that people can't control what they say. I found that sort of both amazing and obviously fascinating. Tell me more about that.
Okay, well, look how fast you're talking now. Look how fast I'm talking. I can't know what I'm going to say next. My subconscious controls it.
Yeah.
Because my subconscious controls it, I leave this in charge. My subconscious is in charge. So we make what's called Freudian slips.
Yeah.
We don't mean to make them. But what people think is, oh, that's a Freudian slip. It's such an obvious one, but people give it away all the time.
And you're trained to look out for that, right?
It just becomes part of who you are. It's just I don't always look out for it. It's just when someone says something and I'm listening to them and I think, oh, that's interesting. And they say something and I say, hang on a second, that contradicts what they just said. So often people contradict themselves. But it's amazing what they tell you about themselves. You can't help it. This is why I need you relaxed. If I get you relaxed, you'll talk away quite happily. As soon as you start talking away quite happily, you've already told me loads about yourself.
One of the things I thought was a technique, which is funny actually, when I was reading it again, because I've watched so many bloody crappy TV and Hollywood films, it did remind me a little bit of a detective trying to get more information out of you. So like when people are telling you a story, I can't really call them, but you just stick a question mark on every... So tell me something about yourself, right?
Okay, so I was born and bred in Brixton.
Brixton, huh?
Oh, yeah, so you do the echoing.
Echoing.
The only trouble with echoing, you're asking a question, and in which case you're changing the conversation.
Okay. Did I misread that?
It's a useful tool. It can be a useful tool, but in essence, it's...
Because it does sound a bit like the kind of clumsy detective going, oh, Brixton.
Yeah, well, someone would say something like... you know, the way we treat Mother Nature. Mother Nature. Yeah, and off they go. Because what they've done is they've given you... So behind words, there are stories.
Yeah.
Things have been difficult recently. So it's a classic. It's what I use again on the course. Things have been difficult recently. So what does that sentence tell you? It tells you nothing.
Okay. So how do we get more out of that?
If you want to, you can echo certain words. Think of that sentence. Things have been difficult recently. Which of those words could you echo to find out more?
Recently?
Yeah.
Difficult?
Yeah.
Things?
Yeah. And have been.
Have been, is that interesting?
Well, of course it could be, because it had been. Does it mean, is it still going on or not?
Oh, is it in the past?
Is it still going on? So out of that sentence, you've got four potential. In fact, you've got five, because the fifth one would be, things have been difficult recently. Because you'd actually do the whole
thing. You're just asking it again.
So the problem with any of those things is if you say things, I'm going to talk about things. If you say difficult, I'm going to talk about difficult.
Interesting.
So you need to meet an echo, although it's a very effective way of asking a question without asking a question, it does actually change the conversation.
How do I, in my future podcasting career, how do I...
Extract the information.
Yeah, just exactly. Yeah. How do I get my guests to be more interesting? There you go.
How do you get them to be more interesting?
Well...
Oh, that's a real...
What can I do to help them?
First and foremost, remember when we was talking and you went, yep. It's known as a minimal encourager. And what it keeps me talking. You have to take your turn in the conversation. You must take your turn. If you don't take your turn, what you've just done now by nodding your head is to take your turn in the conversation. Simply by nodding your head, I will keep talking. If you stop nodding your head and you just stared at me or looked away like that, then guess what's going to happen? I'll stop talking. Yeah. So you've got to look interested. You've got to be interested. First of all, most in life, be interested, not interesting.
That's interesting.
Absolute key to life is that. Be interested, not interesting. People will find out about you. The problem with most people is they want to talk about themselves, like I am at the moment, but this is because I'm doing a podcast.
Yeah.
Just be interested in people. They're always interesting. People have always got a story. Find out their story before you give them yours.
There's so much of getting on with people that is, frankly, about listening and about communication.
Yeah.
You must be very good at it.
It depends how hard I'm working.
Yeah.
And I don't do it all the time. Lewis Hamilton doesn't drive his own car at a takeaway the same way he drives his Formula One car.
No, he doesn't, no.
He'll just get in the car and drive, just the same as we do.
Yeah.
It's just that when you work in, it's different. You know, if my kids come to me with a problem, then I'll work, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense.
Do you know what I mean? But if we're just having a chat, we do a quiz every week, you know, with the COVID and everything. And last night, you know, we had a fabulous time. Everyone taking a mickey out of each other, taking a banter. But I wasn't listening to what was going on. I was only listening to come back at them. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Take the mickey out of dad, and that's got to be done, isn't it? You know, so that's fine. But that's not, you know, I'm not going to sit there, oh God, what all that means. I don't know that. I'll be horrible. I'll be impossible to live with. I might cock up and I shout sometimes. I do all of those things. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
But when I need to, and when it's important, then I listen carefully. But most of the time, no, don't do it. No one will talk to you. No one will talk to you.
You just become a sort of self-righteous sort
of absolutely.
Pain in the ass.
God, yeah, who needs them? Do you know what I mean?
Presumably, you get quite good deals on your cars, though, when you buy a new car.
Not necessarily. I'm not the world's greatest negotiator. I'm buying a house at the moment. No, seriously. Because I'm not too bad at negotiation for cars and stuff. But, I mean, I'm buying a house and I like the person. And that's the trouble. Because I like them. So I don't want to use all the skills on them.
That's interesting, isn't it? Because that shouldn't make a difference.
Of course it shouldn't, but it does. Trust and likability.
But that's such a weird human...
Can't help it.
Odd thing, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's great, isn't it, really?
So just on negotiation, tell me a bit about, I know you're, but the best alternative, Balpa or something. What's
the Batna?
Batna. Zopa as well. What's
yeah, we don't tend to work on the Batna very much. It's the best alternative to a negotiated agreement because we don't negotiate.
Just as a rule.
Well, you can't negotiate with someone's life. Either you win or you lose. That's all there is to it. So to all intents and purposes, we should be crisis communicators.
Oh, that's interesting. So the title is misleading.
It's misleading in the fact that we're meant to negotiate. We do have negotiation skills, obviously we do, but we have more persuasive skills. We're persuaders, really. Your proposal is that death is better than life. That's your proposal. When you're stood on a bridge, you're really saying death is better than life. That's my counter proposal is that life is better than death.
Yeah.
I can't start.
They're quite binary, those two, aren't they?
Well, they kind of work against
you. Yeah. I mean, you can't, there's no compromise in the
middle. There is no compromise in the middle. You can't say, cut your arm off, mate.
Yeah, was in a binary car, you know, I'll give you 500, I'll throw some new bats in.
There is nothing. There's nothing against it. Yeah, and that's what we find ourselves in. So we have to then come up with. Now, in order to come to the solution where you can start to see that life is better than death, I have to listen really carefully to why you think death is better than life.
One of the only things I've ever read about negotiation, and it's one of the best things I've ever read, actually, was that book, Getting to Yes.
Stephen Urey, William Urey.
Yeah, the guys that negotiated the sort of Middle East peace deal in the 80s.
Yeah.
And my memory of that is, if you can find a kind of shared mutual interest, a shared mutual positive outcome, work out what that is, work around that, then that can open up some quite challenging negotiations.
Yeah, I think the thing is that when they come to the Middle Eastern negotiations, everyone wanted it to happen. So that's the first part. They're not going to come, you know, the Taliban are now talking to the Americans, they're now talking to each other. 10 years ago, they wouldn't have spoken to each other. It wasn't the right time. So all of those things come at the right time. And then what you need at that time is both people, both groups, to actually say, okay, look, what's our outcome here? Our outcome is peace, right? Our outcome is to give our people a better life, right? Okay, this has been going on long enough. There is no point in this continuing. Let's see if we can come to a way where we can both walk away with this with our heads held high. Because that's the other issue. You've got to get people to walk away feeling good about themselves. Because if they don't, if you have someone over, they will never trust you. And the trouble is in the past is that they've lied to each other, basically, for all intents and purposes. And that's created this...
It's the worst feeling, isn't it? Yeah. It's happened to me once when I was negotiating with a prospective boss to go and join his company. And he lied to me about some stuff about a business or shares or whatever. And when you find out later on, because you'll find out eventually, right? Maybe years down the line, but when you find out that you lied to at that point, it's nothing, there's nothing more.
No.
It gets to a special place of sort of anger and.
You've been over. No, trust is gone.
You've mugged off.
Once trust is gone, it's gone.
What's a good soundbite to leave our listeners with on the subject of listening?
I suppose I'll give you two things. First and foremost, compose your question properly. If you're going to ask a question, compose it properly. The indirect question is the most powerful question. So the indirect question, tell me about your best boss and why you like working for them. It's an indirect question because as you talk about your boss, you'll be telling me what you're like.
Got it.
So You know, that's the first thing. And if you're going to ask a big open question, then shut up and listen to what they're telling you. Don't jump in too quickly. The more they ramble, the more they give away. And then finally, of course, always be interested and not interesting. It's absolute key. Be interested in the person you're talking to.
Yeah.
Every person has a story to tell. Every person is interested in their own right. And sometimes you meet people who think, I've got no idea why you're like you are. And you don't. But it's great to find out, isn't it?
Can I just do one more thing with you? Because it's just, I'm imagining now that I'm in the nick.
Yeah.
I've been arrested for something.
Yeah.
And I'm just wanted you to give me 2 minutes. I'm trying to persuade me to confess.
I wouldn't get you to confess. I'm not interested in your confession at all.
Why not?
Because I don't need it.
Why do you not need it?
Because all I need to do is get you to talk.
Okay, well, I'm happy to talk to you, but
That's great. Then as soon as you talk to me, if you lie, I'll catch you out and you lie. And if you tell the truth, I'm not.
But you probably know that I'm lying, right? I've been caught with a blood-stained knife.
All right, and I'll say to you, so explain to me how that blood-stained knife on you. Go on, then.
Oh, I was cutting up some meat for the dog.
Okay. What sort of dog you got?
Labrador.
And what sort of meat was it?
Beef.
Where'd you get the meat from?
Tesco's.
Yes, and I'd go through all of that. I'd take you right the way down the line. Take you all the way down the line. And of course, you said you cut up the meat for the dog, were you?
Yeah.
Right, so the blood on there will be the meat, the blood from the meat.
Well, my wife helped me briefly with it.
So you helped, but so the blood is... And what are you saying? And did she cut herself?
She might have done.
Oh, she might have done.
Yeah, I don't know.
You don't know. Wasn't there. You told me that you cut up the meat with you.
No, I didn't.
I think you just did.
No, I didn't, actually.
You said that's how you get your
check
meat.
The time.
I could check it. But I wouldn't be that crude. But again,
what's the most annoying way for someone to behave in that kind of interview situation? Just saying no.
Oh, if first of all, it's a quote within the police, is that the right of silence is only ever introduced by the person that's guilty.
Oh, is that a thing? The whole
it's
no comment.
It's not true. It's
but
not
it's,
true.
It's a good rule of thumb.
But it's a kind of if you haven't done it, why aren't you giving an excuse? Because
this body language, I've just crossed my arms.
Yeah, that's again, kind of like, yeah, so what? Do you know what I mean? Are you comfortable or are you becoming defensive? And if you're becoming defensive, why are you defensive? Is it because I'm asking the questions or you're uncomfortable? Because you're in the police station. I don't know why you're feeling uncomfortable.
But you can see why people want us, who are going to say no comment, because, again, we all watch enough cop shows now to know that if you are guilty and you try to lie,
that's fine.
You're trained to read any number of things.
No, you can't do anything with it. You can't do anything with body language. Body language is a waste of time.
Really?
Well, you can't.
You can tell if someone's lying.
How can you?
Because they'll be shifty and.
Oh, really? By looking away?
Yeah. Well,
I'll tell you now. Your children were competent liars by the age of 8 because you taught them how to do it.
You know when people are lying.
No, I don't know when people are lying. I know. I get an idea, but I don't know. I can't make a sense. No, I don't know.
Okay,
would you be comfortable in the police station? How can you can never use body language in court. It's never
accepted. No, that's what I mean.
In which case, then, it's no value.
No, but if you know that I'm lying, you've got to try and extract a confession out of me.
No, I'm not extract a confession out of you at all.
Why not?
Stop going for a confession.
Come on,
I
did it.
Yeah, you can say you did it. It's up to you. You just confessed. I didn't make you confess. I don't have to.
What makes you a good... Because we haven't really talked about this. A good interviewer. Because we talked about all the listening bit.
I'll get you in the detail. I'll kill you in the detail.
Just what you just did.
Yeah, I'll just catch you straight in the way. You just made up a complete lie. I can disprove your lie. Now stand up and go.
I went to Tel Aviv. Yeah. A few years back, and you know about this. I was trying to get out of the airport, and on the way out, you're in the queue to get out, and these two male female come up to you and go, where's that suitcase from? And one of them looks at your passport, and she's doing this, and the guy, where'd you buy the suitcase? And I said, I bought it in New York. Which shop? The Tunis shop. What's that scratching for? And I'm looking and going, and then she goes, what were you doing in somewhere?
Whatever it was. It must be saying on your passport.
It was a Muslim country. What were you doing in Indonesia? And she goes, why were you there? How long? 3 days. And then she goes, what was the Hilton like? And I said, I didn't stay at Hilton. She goes, yes, you did. I said, no, I didn't. But it's really full on.
Yeah.
To leave the country. What? Are they just, I guess, are they trying to get me flustered or are they trying to...
I really don't know. To be honest with you, I mean, there's no point in any of that because you become flustered. You think, oh, fuck, what does that help?
I didn't have much sleep as well.
Yeah, none of that helps. I mean, but the reality is, I don't know what they do. It's kind of like people crack. I guess if I
was a bullshitting wrongman...
You just tell me, say, why are you asking me these questions? Why are you asking me these questions? Is there an issue? Have you got an issue with me? Because if you've got an issue with me, tell me what it is.
But your way to get someone to crack is on detail.
I don't have to get you the crack. I just need you to tell me a story. You tell me a story, I'll destroy your story. If I can destroy your story, what are you going to say in court?
So you'll destroy my story in the details because
that you give me. Yeah.
Because they're not true.
Yeah, well, you're going to go for a meal now, I'm assuming. That's what you said. Okay, you're going to go for a meal, okay? Yeah. And then you're going to meet somebody there, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, then if you said to me, I went for a meal at wherever you're going to, I'd say, okay, who served you?
I can't tell. Some woman.
Oh, some woman. Okay, so she's a woman. How old was she?
Well, I haven't been there.
No, you haven't had it yet. But let's imagine.
I have been there before. So okay, that's so this so I can remember that a blonde lady in her mid-20s served me.
Okay, and where were you sat?
I was sat in the corner.
When you say in the corner, explain to me the corner. Describe to me the corner.
It's a sort of booth. It's next to
we'll stop there.
Because it's true. I guess what I'm saying is true. Yeah.
And I'd be able to go back there, and there's a fair chance. You've got a 50-50 chance of the person being on duty. So that's the thing. If you say to me, oh, I went to the bar. All right, so was it male or woman? There's a 50-50 chance you're going to get, because there may not be any women that night.
Yeah.
There may not be any men on that night. You don't know. How much did you pay for the drink? How much did you pay for the meal? What did you have to eat? Because you remember what you had to eat. How much did you pay for it? Roughly. And you say, oh, about 60 quid. 60 quid, okay. So you go along there and you see, okay, is it roughly 60 quid? Detail will kill you every time. I don't need you to tell me the truth. I just need you to talk.
Well, would you in the interview say, you go, that's bullshit? Or you're lying?
No, I don't need to.
So all the stuff I see on the TV.
Oh, you might at the end say, listen, mate. I'll tell you what I do. I always do at the very end, I say to him, I say, is what you just told me the truth? And if they say yes, now they're committed to the story. I say, that's okay. I say, I'll tell you what I'm going to do now, right? Just to let you know. I'm going to go away. I'm going to check all this. And if it's bullshit, you're fucked.
Yeah.
And if it's the truth, you can walk. Now, let me ask you again. Is this the truth?
I love it. I wanted to get out of something. I don't think I've got anything to hide. Good.
You start to see that you don't need... You know, this idea of getting a confession is so passé, it's bollocks. And good cop, bad cop's bollocks. Everyone knows. Because if you try it on me, I'll go, so you're a bad cop, are you? And you're a good cop.
Yeah.
Just, what are you going to do then? You going to hit me?
Richard, thank you so much for talking to us today. It's been fascinating and an amazing life story, amazing journey, and lots of really helpful tips for that. How to be my better listener. So thank you very much.
My pleasure.
You have been listening to the Do Podcast with me, Gav Thompson. Thank you so much for listening. Please do leave me a review and subscribe, and please do email me with any comments or feedback to gav@thedolectures.co.uk. The rest of Seasons 1 episodes will be released every Friday. This podcast was produced by George McDonough with music by James Morton. Goodbye.